Good afternoon and welcome to Statewide Grand Rounds, provided by the New York State Office of Mental Health's Bureau of Psychiatric Services and Research Institute Support. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Lloyd Setterer, Medical Director of the New York State Office of Mental Health, and I'll be your host for today's presentation, which we call Applying the Social Determinants of Mental Health in Clinical Practice, What Clinicians Can Do. The New York State Office of Mental Health is accredited by the Medical Society of the State of New York to provide continuing medical education credit to physicians. We select our Grand Rounds topics and develop the content of each program with OMH psychiatrists and physicians in mind. We also welcome viewers from other mental health service systems and professions and hope that these programs will be of benefit to you as well. I want to remind you that the slides for today's program and additional resources are available at the OMH internal continuing medical education website. Please remember that you need to be an OMH employee to access that secure site. You can also use our internal website to view archived videos of previous statewide grand rounds, and we have a really robust library. We hope you'll take a look at that for those that you didn't get a chance to see live. The website address is listed at the bottom of the screen. But don't despair. If you're not an OMH employee, you can still view archived statewide grand rounds videos on the OMH internet web page. These videos are posted to the New York State OMH external website about 2 or 3 weeks after the live broadcast at the website, now also listed at the bottom of your screen. We're going to open our phone lines towards the end of the program, and we invite your questions via our toll-free number. Well, that will be later in the program. Please give us a call. We like it when you call. It gives us a chance to understand what you're interested in and try to respond to that. So let's turn to the program. We're really thrilled to welcome our guest today, Dr. Ruth Shim, who's Vice Chair of Education and Faculty Development and Chief of the Outpatient Psychiatric Services at the Lenox Hill Hospital. She's also Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the Hofstra North Shore LIJ School of Medicine, which she tells me is going to have a new name, but we won't reveal that until it comes out. In the interest of full disclosure, Dr. Ruth Shim is the co-author of a book called The Social Determinants of Mental Health, published by American Psychiatric Press. I have read this book. It is a terrific book, which she is a co-author with Dr. Michael Compton. This is a fantastic compilation, I think the first of its sort that actually addresses the social determinants of mental health. It's also out in this year, 2015. All of the other faculty and planners associated with this activity have indicated that they have no financial arrangements or affiliations with any commercial entities whose products, research, or services may be discussed in these materials. Any discussion of investigational or unlabeled uses of a product will be identified. So let's get to the content now. Even though it's widely accepted that social determinants have a far greater impact on health than the actual provision of health care for individuals or population, our clinical care systems often fail to integrate this information, this knowledge, at the level of the direct patient care encounter for our individual patients. The social determinants of health are those factors that impact upon health and well-being. They are the circumstances into which we are born, grow up, live, work, and age, including the health system, but that's actually a small proportion of the impact. So to promote wellness and recovery, clinicians will need to understand and address the relationships between and the impact of the social determinants, the context of our life, on our mental health. And we're fortunate Dr. Shim's going to first educate us with a conceptual foundation along with some evidence-based examples of the social determinants of mental health. We're going to also discuss what this means to clinicians and identify ways in which we, as clinicians, can make a difference. At the conclusion of the program, participants should be able to, first, define the concept of the social determinants of mental health. Second, understand the strongest evidence supporting, by example, two social determinants of mental health. They're not the only two, but we're going to illustrate those. And third, talk about and identify two also specific activities that mental health clinicians like us can engage in to actually address, to respond to the social determinants of mental health. So now let me turn this over to Dr. Shem.
Well, thank you very much, Lloyd. And I would like to take a little bit of time to redefine the social determinants of health, which you so eloquently stated. And we do call the social determinants of health and mental health those factors that impact upon health and well-being, the circumstances into which we are born, grow up, live, work, and age, including the health system. But I'd actually like to take that even one step further and add to that, as the World Health Organization added to that information, by stating that these circumstances are shaped by the distribution of money, power, and resources at the global, national, and local levels, which are themselves influenced by policy choices. And that's a really key point, because what we're talking about there is the idea that these are political decisions that are made that create the health outcomes that we see. And it's the decisions that we make about how we are distributing money, power, and resources in our society that have an impact on our health and our well-being.
And often these are not topics that mental health clinicians may specifically think about going into their office or a clinic or a hospital, but in fact, we can. And you're going to show us some examples.
Exactly. And the last little piece of the definition that I think is so key for us to know is that the social determinants of health are prominently responsible for the health disparities and inequities that we see in our society. So when we think about that, we can think about a lot of different outcomes for health and how these many different outcomes affect different populations in different ways. So in some ways, there are some groups that have really positive and good health, physical and mental, and then there are other population groups that have higher rates of mental illness, higher rates of physical illness. And the social determinants of health and mental health are the things that are most responsible or oftentimes largely responsible for these differences and inequities that we see.
Right. And so if we're going to make a difference in the health and mental health of our patients, we're going to have to think beyond the small envelope of the care delivery system, because that's what's making a big difference. And it's making a bigger difference for some people than others. That's
exactly
what disparities is about.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really an issue of social justice, which is a concept that public health really understands and that I think mental health professionals need to think about a little bit.
Right.
So the social determinants of health, as we've defined them, are these concepts. But the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation took some time to do a little bit of research in this area, because what they found was that depending on your political background, the terms and the terminology may not resonate equally among political groups. And we've described that these are political decisions, that political decisions lead to these determinants. And therefore, they discussed language and statements that resonate with any political background, no matter where you are or what your political beliefs are. Mm-hmm. Because everybody wants everyone to have the same opportunity to be healthy. Everybody wants people to live well, no matter what your political background. But they did find that certain terms and certain statements resonate with both political parties or any political background, and that's these concepts: that health begins where we live, learn, work, and play, and that your zip code may be more important to your overall health than your genetic code.
That's really such a key statement about the zip code, because it's another number. So we're socialized as doctors, as clinicians, to think about numbers like your hemoglobin A1C or your lipid level.
Right.
But you're pointing out that actually there's another number called the zip code, which actually may have even more bearing than what our low-density lipoprotein may be. And the problem is that there's no statin for a zip code.
Exactly.
We're going to have to find another approach.
We have to find other approaches, and there are other approaches.
Mm-hmm.
And the key is getting mental health professionals and clinicians to start thinking about their role in these other approaches.
Right. I should say, because we do say that there's more to controlling your lipids than taking a statin.
Absolutely.
How you live and what you eat and how you live your activity. And so there's some overlap, in fact.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, these are concepts that we understand. We understand the biopsychosocial model. We understand that it's not just your genetics, but it also has a lot to do with your psychological background and the social environment that you live in.
Right.
So these aren't exactly new concepts, but they deserve to be reemphasized and have us think about it in a slightly different way.
Yes.
So if we think about these determinants of health and their contributions to premature death, we can look at a graph and see that according to the dark blue pie on this pie chart, that about 30% of the total contribution to premature death comes from your genetic predisposition. But that leaves about 70% of determinants of health that contribute to your premature death that don't have to do with your genetics. So this is that issue of your zip code being more important than your genetic code and various other environmental factors like your behavior patterns, the choices that you make, the decisions that you make about what healthy choices you choose or what unhealthy choices you might decide to undertake. The healthcare system, which we've already discussed, has a role to play.
Let me ask you a little bit about that 30% on the genetics portion of the pie.
Yes.
And in fact, that's not static either, that we've learned that actually our genes are turned on and off by how we live and where we live.
Yes.
So that it's far more than 70% that we're talking about.
Yeah, you bring up such an important point, Lloyd, because even when we talk about genetics, we're still talking about the impact on the environment. We're still talking about epigenetics and gene by environment interactions. So it really, you could look at the entire 100% and say that there are social factors that are contributing here, which is pretty striking.
That's pretty striking.
Yeah.
That says about it. That means everything, right?
It really does. Yeah. It really does. And that's why we need to start thinking a little bit more about our role as clinicians in addressing these factors.
Right. But let me take a moment and depart a bit from the script and some of the slides, and ask you about some concepts that may be familiar and some may not be so familiar to some of the people tuning in. And those are the public health concepts of primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. Can you just explain to us what those are, and then let's see how they may overlap, in fact, with what you're talking about today.
Great. It actually kind of perfectly overlaps. We think about prevention in a lot of different fields, not as much in mental health, but it is an area that we need to be kind of moving into focus more and focusing more on. Primary prevention is trying to prevent the incidence of an illness, so intervening and doing something to prevent an illness from starting in the first place. So so that would be at the very beginning, making some sort of intervention before anything is wrong at all.
So an example of that might be not smoking.
Exactly.
Would be primary prevention. Or if you've got a family history of mental illness and you're a teenager, not smoking marijuana because you've got a vulnerable brain. Those are examples of primary prevention.
Those are great examples. Mm-hmm. I think a classic example would be vaccinations as
right,
well.
Right.
You're preventing an illness from occurring at all and intervening in order to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Secondary intervention is the way we think about early intervention.
Right.
And so typically it's screening tests that we do, or all the many ways that we screen for disease.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're screening for a disease, you're catching the disease at the very earliest stages so that you can intervene and prevent it from becoming something very, very severe. So it could be doing a pap smear to prevent cervical cancer, or it could be doing a depression screen
mm-hmm.
to catch depression before it becomes an extremely severe disease.
Right.
So there's any number. In general, it's just a good idea to think of it as performing screening tests.
Right. Is it only the performance of the screening test, or is it coupled with intervening early? Does secondary prevention mean also getting involved and helping
does.
Somebody
it
early in the course?
It absolutely does.
Mm-hmm.
It's once you've identified it, it would then be taking action to prevent it from becoming more of a problem.
Right. So all of our clinicians understand early detection and early intervention.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
Tertiary?
So tertiary is probably what most clinicians spend their time doing,
mm-hmm.
and it is really trying to reduce the morbidity associated with an illness.
Right.
So it's really focusing on treating the illness after it has kind of fully manifest.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that most of us spend time mm-hmm. treating severe forms of depression and bipolar disorder and schizophrenia and other illnesses. And so we are practicing prevention in those ways, but that would be considered tertiary prevention.
Right, right. So is are social determinants a form of primary prevention?
Yes, they're absolutely a form of primary prevention. If you think about primary prevention as we described as intervening before a disease even
mm-hmm.
occurs,
mm-hmm.
then that's really, when we talk about the social determinants and we're really thinking about underlying factors, these factors that come in long prior to a disease becoming manifest in a person. And so it's probably one of the purest ways that we could practice primary prevention.
All right, terrific. And you're going to give us some more particulars on this.
I'm going to elaborate on that. You've actually led me into the next slide, which is really conceptualizing what the social determinants of mental health are. And we call the social determinants of mental health the causes of the causes. This comes from Sir Michael Marmot and Jeffrey Rose in the UK. They called it the causes of the causes, or Link and Phelan refer to these as the fundamental causes of diseases. So if you think about the idea that we have risk factors, these underlying factors that lead to disease, things like smoking, any number of things can be a risk factor, anything that comes before a disease. And then if you think about the idea that risk factors come before the disease, the environmental and the contextual factors that precede the risk factor are considered the causes of the causes.
Right.
So those are the social determinants of mental health. If mm-hmm. you have risk factors and then you go back even before the risk
right.
factor,
right.
then you're really hitting the social determinants of health and mental health.
Right. So it may be that where you live is going to be a key driver of whether you smoke or not, or
absolutely.
How you, what nutrition you take in, or what kind of activity or what kind of education you have, or what kind of discrimination you may be subject to.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those things we know are risk factors for disease. And so these environmental things drive those
causes
risk factors.
Of causes.
The causes of the causes. And so, you know, I'd like to show this picture that helps us to conceptualize the social determinants of mental health. And it's a very busy and complicated slide, but I'm going to just take a little bit of time to explain it to everybody. This is how we think about the social determinants of mental health. And if you start at the very top of this makeshift pyramid, you see that at the top we have poor mental health, disease, and morbidity. And then you can start to work down the pyramid and you can start to see those things that drive this poor mental health, disease, and morbidity. So the first thing that we believe drives that are the risk that we talk about, these risk factors. And even before that, you have things like reduced options, poor choices, high risk behaviors, and stress. And those issues tend to drive the behavioral risk factors that drive disease. And where we conceptualize the social determinants of health and mental health are before that, even back before. So when we say the causes of causes, we're talking about shaded concepts mm-hmm. that we have here. And so we've conceptualized the social determinants of mental health as these nine factors. And of course, that's a very artificial way to think about it because it's hard to tease all of these things out into separate categories. But if we want to try and think about this, we have to start to categorize things. So we've thought about it as under and unemployment and job insecurity, food insecurity, the poor adverse features of
you
the built environment.
Food insecurity, it's such an important term that not many people may know about.
Absolutely. Food insecurity, the most basic definition is just not being unsure of where your food is going to come from or not being sure that you'll have enough food to eat.
Yes.
So if you have a typical period of time, a week, it might be that by the end of the week you might be unsure as to where you're going to get your food from.
Because so you've used what money you have and you don't know how you're going to buy a next meal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Number of people in the United States who experience food insecurity is very high.
It's a very high number, and it's actually about 16% mm-hmm. of the population.
So one in six people in this country
food insecure in a typical year, mm-hmm. which is a very mm-hmm. concerning
yeah.
number.
Yes.
And, you know, as we talk about this, is very closely tied to things like poverty because not having enough food has to do with if you can afford food and access where you live mm-hmm. has to do with where you can, whether or not you can access healthy foods.
Right.
So some of the other social determinants include adverse features of the built environment, and so that would be things like making sure that that's anything that's man-made. So it's living around power lines, mm-hmm. not having access to proper transportation, not living in a place where there are parks or living in, you know, really poor housing quality.
Right.
These are all aspects of the built environment. And related to that, there's housing insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
So not having a stable place to live or being homeless, these are aspects of housing insecurity. And then also on this list, we have on the bottom of the bottom four, we consider kind of some of the more fundamental social determinants of mental health. And that includes adverse early life experiences, which we're going to spend a little
right.
bit more time talking about. Discrimination and social exclusion, which you know drives a lot of isolation and can then lead to the factors that the mental health factors that we've talked about, poor education, and then poverty and income inequality, which we're also going to spend a little bit of time elaborating on. And then below all of this, we have the distribution of opportunity in our society,
yeah.
and what we're saying there is that the way we distribute opportunity is not random,
mm-hmm.
That these are political decisions and that they are driven by our public policies and our social norms.
Right.
So we make decisions about who is important and who is not important.
And it's multi-generational. So
absolutely.
If you're born into a particular neighborhood or a particular state of disadvantage, it's very hard to escape that. So one generation begets the next generation's problems.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you've put that really well. We also on this graph have poor access to care, which is a result of the health system. And we talked about how the health system is a small piece of this, and that's why it's kind of off to the side a little bit. It's driven a little bit differently than mm-hmm. the rest of these factors, but it is still a determinant of health. And then off in the right corner, we have that genetic piece. We have genetic risk, pathogens, toxins, and injury, and that G by E is gene by environment interactions.
Right.
So they also play a role, and you can see how the determinants there through epigenetics then lead to genetic risk, or can also, and that stress can also lead to that as well. So I've tried to take a very complicated diagram and kind of distill it down. And the only other thing I'll add here is that
I would say that viewers can get this slide on our internal website. And so those of you who may want to look at it again or be reminded of it, so we're going to post that with the program materials as well.
Yeah.
And it is a busy, but it needs to be, because that's how much that's going on, and we don't want to leave one out.
Right. And, yeah. It's funny, because when you think about the social determinants of mental health, we're really kind of talking about everything.
Yeah.
You know, you can't really... It's almost everything we encounter in society, and so trying to distill that down into...
But in some ways, the neat thing about it is it gives us a very big target. We don't want just one big blurry target. There are different pieces, but there are many ways by which we can address these determinants.
And absolutely.
I'm going to give some examples as
yes,
well.
Yes, definitely. And so the last slide I want to talk about right now is this health impact pyramid, which was created by Tom Frieden and published in the American Journal of Public Health. And this pyramid kind of helps to understand how public health works. It really just describes what public health is. But if you notice, as you move down the pyramid, you're having greater population impact. And the higher up you are on the pyramid, the more individual effort that's needed. And so I would say that most clinicians spend their time working in the top parts of the pyramid. So they're working in the areas of counseling education, and they're providing clinical interventions.
Right.
And that's really important work.
Let's go back to that, because maybe you want to just take a moment and look at the other layers. I do have to... For those who may not know Tom Frieden, Tom is now the director of the CDC, but previously he was the health commissioner in New York City, and in that regard I got to know him pretty well because he was my boss for 5 years in the early phase, opening 5 years of the Bloomberg administration. So, but he is a very accomplished public health doctor, and this has been part of his effort to help us understand all of the determinants. But do you want to detail a little bit more here?
Yeah. So the clinicians, we tend to work up at these top two. But as you move down the pyramid, you see that things like long-lasting protective interventions, changing the context to make individuals' default decisions healthy, and then acting on socioeconomic factors,
right,
that these have the greatest population impact.
Right.
And so when we think about addressing the social determinants of health and where we're going to have the most impact, we have to be working at the bottom of this pyramid.
And we're going to make a lot more people's lives better as a result.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I do think it's important to say that what's happening at the top of the pyramid is still very valid, and that's why we're going to spend some time today talking about the relevance of making clinical interventions and individual interventions with patients.
Right.
But always keeping in mind that it's down at the bottom of the pyramid where we have the greatest impact.
In other words, it's not there in no way mutually exclusive.
Exactly.
The more that we can operate on these different pyramidal levels, the better the population is going to be.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of the slides that I wanted to go through for this beginning part of our discussion.
Right. So this is a tremendous educational opportunity. Most people in our mental health field may not be exposed to this type of material. So it's just... really welcome your focusing in on it. But what may be hard for people to understand is, well, I didn't go to social work school, or I didn't go to medical school or psychology school or nursing school to engage in an anti-poverty campaign, or to produce healthier housing, or to enable more nutritious foods to be affordable to many more people. Where's the connection between all of us who didn't necessarily go to school for this, yet discovering that with something we need to focus on?
I think it's a really relevant question, and I I also didn't go to medical school with that in mind. But what happened personally for me is that I started bumping up against these determinants in my day-to-day interactions with patients.
Yes.
And what I found is that I was trained to, you know, do a very comprehensive diagnostic assessment and then to come up with a treatment plan that oftentimes the intervention included medication and therapy. That was kind of the key.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be very effective. I mean, we know that these are really effective treatments for people that suffer from mental illnesses. But what was challenging is that I would go set about performing these interventions and find that in certain patients who had many of these determinants, there was not any significant improvement happening.
Right.
And the challenge was, you know, if my goal and my calling is to help people with serious mental illness or any type of mental illness, and they're in fact not getting better with the treatment that I'm providing, then what is missing, and where's the piece that I've forgotten about or left out? And that's really what led me to think more about these issues. And I'm not the only one. We have very comprehensive supported programs in place to address various factors in the environment that affect patients with mental illness. Things like supported employment, supportive housing, supportive education. These things are in place.
Wellness programs.
They're in place for this particular reason, because we already know, because the evidence supports how important these factors are in improving the mental health of the people that we serve.
So your personal, thank you for that personal story, because it is a way for us to appreciate that if we do our clinical thing and we discover that our patient or patients are not getting better, it's our job to ask why not, rather than to be judgmental. It's our job to be inquisitive, and what we may discover is that they don't have a reliable place to live.
Exactly.
Or they haven't been able to have enough money to eat and to buy medicine, even if they're on Medicaid.
Yes.
That those are the factors that we've got to uncover in order to enable somebody to benefit from a treatment.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's what you discovered, and that just in broadened your calling.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like I said, and I have to emphasize, it's something that we all know, and that many people have discovered, and going back for, you know, many years, this is information we know. I think though that our field has sometimes taken our eye off of this fact, and gone down a route of looking at biological interventions and genetic origins of illnesses, and I think that's very important, but I think we can't neglect these social determinants of mental health as well.
It's not enough to just try to get the genetic code or somebody's likelihood to respond to this antidepressant or that.
Exactly.
Because if they're not eating enough, or if they're so overwhelmed by stress because they don't have a place to live, or there's violence in the home.
Exactly.
Yeah. These are big things. So maybe do we want to then turn to some of the examples that you have?
Let's
open those up as a way of expanding on the topic.
I think we could talk a little bit now about adverse early childhood experiences.
Please, yes.
And I think that we have lots and lots of data on this, and I know you know the data as well as I do, that depending on your experiences as a child, if you've had traumatic experiences as a child, your risk for developing mental health problems as an adult is quite significant.
Even as a teenager?
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
When you say child, what ages are you?
From infancy all the way to the end of adolescence.
Right.
So you know, 0 to 18, that in these formative years, if you've experienced any type of trauma or adverse experience. It doesn't even have to be to the level of what we would consider to be a trauma, but it has an impact on your mental health as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
It increases your risk of developing depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorder. It increases your risk of substance use disorders. It increases your risky behaviors. So any number of poor choices in terms of diet, in terms of sexual activity, it can increase your risk for a number of physical illnesses as well as mental health problems.
Like heart disease, even cancer.
Exactly.
Lung diseases. And what are these adverse childhood experiences? These are what we call ACEs.
These are ACEs.
Being delivered an ACE is not a good thing, like in cards.
This is not a good ACE. And these are ACEs that were described by Folletti and Anda when they did a study of a middle-class population in California in Kaiser Permanente. And
that was quite a while ago.
It was. I can't remember the exact
90s,
date.
I think, yeah.
And they looked at a number of things. They looked at abuse. They looked at neglect. And they looked at a vague group of things they called household dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was things like witnessing a mother being abused, having a family member that was incarcerated, observing acts of violence in the home.
Mm-hmm.
So these types of adverse childhood experiences, they ended up putting them together and creating an ACE score.
Mm-hmm.
The number that you had correlated directly with the score, the number of ACEs was your ACE score. So so you had a possibility of a total of 10. You could have 0 all the way up to 10. They actually found in their population that 60% of this population had at least one. So they're highly prevalent, these ACEs. And that has been replicated in many different populations and looked at in a lot of different areas. So there is a high likelihood that people have experienced an adverse childhood experience at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these are kind of retrospective, thinking back as an adult.
Right. But the the cumulative evidence over many, many studies, many years, not just in California, 17 years ago, has just reiterated this point again, and that these experiences that a child or a youth may have are predictors, in a way, of the likelihood of having health and mental health problems, and they're cumulative. Do you want to say something about that?
I think one of the best studies that looks at this actually looks at the number of ACEs and its relation to the risk of having a suicide attempt in adulthood. And actually what they found is that it's an exponential relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So the more ACEs you have, the more risk you have of having a suicide attempt as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because it's exponential. If you have more than 7 adverse childhood experiences, you have almost 30 times the risk of attempting suicide as somebody who has 0. Yes, which is a really shocking figure when you think about it. It's one of those things where, you know, we treat and deal with so much suicidal ideation as clinicians, and thinking about how closely related and how high the risk is in people that have had a large number of adverse childhood experiences makes us kind of rethink the way we consider suicidality in our individual patients.
Yes, and there is an opportunity then in pediatric practices, in general medical practice, family practice, to identify in a quantitative way with a score.
Yes,
those youth who have adverse childhood experiences, those who have not just one, but 4 or 5 or 6, who are on a course almost definitively to mental health problems, teenage pregnancy, substance problems by the time they're teenagers or young adults.
Yeah.
That's where detection can occur. It might also even occur in schools.
Yeah, you're talking about performing a simple screening intervention, and then after screening, hopefully we could provide extra support, maybe a therapeutic intervention for those children that are at highest risk.
And that intervention often involves the family, particularly the mother.
Mm-hmm.
There are different programs that have focused on this, on childhood trauma.
Yes.
There's a National Traumatic Stress Network focused on children. But there are also programs that build skills with families, with mothers, so that they can be more protective and help their kids. So it's not that we don't have examples of how to help, but this is not going on. As far as I can tell.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because we actually know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
We have answers, and we have data that shows that these interventions, that identification of these adverse childhood experiences, and then intervening can actually make a difference. We have successful interventions that
mm-hmm.
have decreased the risk of adverse childhood experiences, and those children have gone on, and we've looked at this, and those children have gone on to be healthier and
right.
to have less poor mental health outcomes in
right.
adulthood.
Right. One of the best TED Talks I've ever seen is by a pediatrician, Dr. Nadine Harris,
mm-hmm.
Where she, like you, in the way that you described, discovered that the problem with her being able to care for the kids in her practice didn't have to do with choosing the right antibiotic. It had to do with what was going on in their lives, and she's become a passionate advocate for the detection and intervention around with youth who are exposed to these problems. Maybe what we're highlighting here is an opportunity for New York exemplify our pioneer work. We've done some fantastic work with depression screening and
mm-hmm.
intervention. We're starting that now with alcohol and substance abuse. Maybe it's time for us to get
yep.
started with ACEs as well.
And you know, the ACE score questionnaire is widely available on the internet.
Yes.
So you can just pull it up and that's a way that any clinician could already just start.
It's something
on their
that
own.
our clinicians could take a look at and
absolutely.
Themselves use. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
We could talk a little bit about poverty as a social
yes.
determinant. And we know, just like we know about adverse childhood experiences, we have a lot of data that looks at poverty and looks at income inequality and how that affects mental health. There's the technical term is the socioeconomic gradient.
Okay.
This idea that mm-hmm. wherever you are, whatever phase you are in on the socioeconomic status ladder,
mm-hmm.
there is an actual kind of gradient of health. So
right.
those people at the very top, economically and status-wise, do better than those people at the bottom, and in a stepwise fashion as you move up the social class.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the studies on this have been done in England, where there is kind of a more specific delineation of class. In this country, we don't necessarily kind of divide up class in such a clear way.
Mm-hmm.
We do kind of look at socioeconomic status. We have a federal poverty line.
Right.
But we don't necessarily, there's not really kind of a clear cutoff point for what is middle class
mm-hmm.
versus what is upper class versus what's lower. And so the studies that have been done in England looked at your grade, your employment grade, and your status
mm-hmm.
in work in a study called the Whitehall study. They looked at your status in work in your work in terms of your grade as an employee
mm-hmm.
and found that health and mental health directly followed this stepwise fashion. So the executives in the company had significantly better health outcomes
mm-hmm.
than the secretaries or the custodial workers in that same company.
And how is that mediated? I'm sure there's a lot known about that as well.
There are, I think, a lot of factors that tend to mediate the health, those health outcomes. And I think when we think about things like, in addition to income, it has a lot to do with your status, as we talked about, but also your overall housing situation, your environment that you're in, and those factors also come into play.
And is there then the way that that translates itself into our psychology and our physiology? Is being poor, is having a housing uncertainty causing stress? Is the mediator stress? Is it then all of the stress response and cortisol problems and these ways by which our body begins to react to our, is that what's going on?
I believe that definitely plays a part. Mm-hmm. And we've, you know, they have looked at this. They've looked at toxic stress. Mm-hmm. They've looked at telomeres and, mm-hmm. and how mm-hmm. that affects, how the stress of the everyday life for somebody affects their overall health. So there are people that are much more well-versed on mm-hmm. this topic than I mm-hmm. am that recognize that basically if you live a stressful life, a life of poverty, a life
right.
of poor poor environmental options, mm-hmm. That you tend to have higher rates of stress, toxic stress, and that stress then has an impact on your health.
Yes, not everybody may know what a telomere is, but we should know what telomeres. These are these little caps. They're protein caps on our DNA strands,
mm-hmm.
and there's a relation between how long they are and how well we are and how long we live. So
correct.
We all want long telomere, long caps, because when they wear down, we wear down.
Yes.
And what wears them down is stress and diet and other kinds of things that we can influence.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Telomeres are really interesting.
They're fascinating,
yeah.
and it really gets to that whole genetic mm-hmm. issue that we
right.
talked about, and the interaction between the environment and stress.
Right. Right.
So also related, we haven't spent any time talking about income inequality,
yes.
which is a huge political hot-button issue right now.
Are you an advocate for the $15 an hour wage?
I think that when people have a living wage, mm-hmm. they're more healthy.
Right.
If we have less people in poverty, we will have better health outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of consistent.
Right.
And we know that we have the data. We know that people that live in poverty have poor physical health. They have higher rates of hypertension,
mm-hmm.
But they also have higher rates of depression.
Right.
They have higher rates of PTSD, and they have higher rates of substance use.
Mm-hmm.
And so interventions that give more people the opportunity to not live in poverty.
Right,
anything we can
wage.
Do to have less people in poverty actually improves the health of our entire society.
Yeah, yeah. So
income inequality is particularly interesting because, you know, the question becomes, how is it that the inequality itself leads to health problems?
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of different theories on why, if you have more people who are rich and more people who are poor, if that gap is wide, that
right.
that also impacts on health. Some of the thoughts are that
the greater the disparities, the more the adverse consequences.
Exactly. Yeah.
Can you say some more about that?
Well, the thought is that when people are aware of this, that increases stress,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so
right,
when we
right.
know that there's greater income inequality in a society, when we can all look at it and see it, that there's higher rates of stress among those in poverty,
mm-hmm.
and that higher stress level then leads to the greater
right.
health out in the poorer health outcomes that we see.
Where does discrimination come in?
I think that discrimination has a huge role to play. I think that when we, in terms of its own determinant,
mm-hmm.
I think that it leads to that same level of stress that we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got data to support that certain populations that have higher rates of discrimination have higher rates of hypertension, have higher rates of cortisol hormones. Mm-hmm. So stress then leads to poorer health outcomes.
So this is in part about self-image and how a bad self-image as a product of discrimination can actually erode our health.
So it's a really complicated topic, mm-hmm. right? Because that's one piece. But then there's also kind of the entire societal structure, right? Because if we think about discrimination, mm-hmm. that prevents people from living in the right housing.
Right.
That prevents people from living in environments that are healthier environments. It prevents people from getting the right employment that then leads them to be financially secure.
Right.
So it becomes this driver mm-hmm. of all of these other determinants.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons why we feel it's a fundamental determinant, because the discrimination then leads to many of the other determinants.
Right. Makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense, yes.
The other thing that I wanted to say about income inequality is that there's a measure of income inequality. There's something called the Gini. There's many ways to measure income inequality, but one of the ways I think that's most commonly used is something called the Gini coefficient.
Yes.
And it's a measure from 0 to 1, where 1 is more unequal society or more unequal country or however, wherever you can go all the way down to a zip code or a census tract, mm-hmm. all the way to 0, which would be completely equal. They found that in certain studies they've looked at, they found that more unequal countries have higher rates of mental health problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then more unequal states, they've actually done this study and looked at the 50 states, that the states that are more unequal have higher rates of depression than on a population level than states that are less
unequal.
What would
be an example of states where there are lower rates of depression versus higher?
Yeah, New York is actually an outlier, so we probably
shouldn't talk about New York because
we're actually doing pretty well. Okay. We're one of the most unequal states in the country, but we actually don't have the same rates of depression. We have lower rates of depression than, we don't follow the curve.
Okay.
So
we're
we
an
would
outlier
expect,
in that
yes, we would expect to have extremely high rates of depression. Instead, mm-hmm. we have lower rates of depression, and I think it's a testament to all of the great mental health interventions mm-hmm. that we have and the support and the funding that we have to be able to implement really great interventions.
Outliers are really important in terms of understanding what else is going on, because the way to explain an outlier is to look for more explanation.
Exactly.
Right, yes.
Exactly. But a kind of more typical thing would be, for instance, that some of our southern states are mm-hmm. highly unequal. So
yeah.
Alabama, Mississippi, there's high levels of income inequality, and they have very high rates of depression mm-hmm. In those states.
Right. And how about even in neighboring neighborhoods, if you will, Watts and Beverly Hills?
Yeah.
Yonkers and Scarsdale.
Exactly.
What do we know about that?
I don't have that data off the top of my head. I would expect, mm-hmm. though, mm-hmm. I would expect it would follow the same trends that we're talking about.
Yeah.
And so anything that we can do, there's lots of different interventions on the policy level mm-hmm. to address income inequality. You know, there's tax credits, there's mm-hmm. Many other policies that support decreasing income inequality, and we have, you know, like I said, all of our political candidates mm-hmm. are mm-hmm. campaigning on this issue,
right.
no matter what
and
their background.
And sometimes even getting down to our day-to-day practice, it's about knowing that there may be social services or entitlement programs that can help somebody in terms of whether they may not get their wage increase, but they may be entitled to food stamps, or they may be entitled to some type of tax incentive or tax credit.
Yes.
Other ways by which their actual real absolute income would be greater.
Wonderful. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that actually leads into some of my slides here.
Oh, okay.
Because when we want to talk a little bit about how clinicians can intervene, these are some areas and some ways that clinicians can intervene.
Did you, were there other areas that you wanted to touch on before going to the slides?
The only other thing I wanted to add is that if somebody's more interested in how income inequality on a whole impacts health and mental health, there's a great book on this called The Spirit Level.
Oh, yes.
Written by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, and it's available on Amazon and other places.
When did that come out?
I think it was in about 2003 or 2004.
Yeah, so it's been around for a while. Mm-hmm. And what do they mean by the spirit level?
I actually am not 100% sure on what they mean by that.
It's a great title.
Yeah, it's a wonderful title. I didn't take the time to really focus on what it meant. Mm-hmm. But I do know that the data is really strongly presented for almost every health outcome that you can think of. You can see this very clear trend that the more unequal, the worse the health outcome. Yeah. It doesn't really matter what you're talking about.
Right. Okay, so let's move on to then some additional slides and particulars about the clinical setting.
So we can talk about some clinical interventions because, like we said, that's working at the top of the pyramid, but it's yet still an important place to be working. And so we've already described some of the secondary preventive interventions we can do, the types of screening that we might be able to do. So, for instance, a perfect example of that would be to screen, to check everybody's ACE score. To run a test and see what number, that would be a really easy clinical intervention that somebody could take. You could actually address policies in your own clinic and practice, and I will say that we're going to talk a little bit more about that on the next slide, so I'll hold on that one. One of the easiest ways, I think, would be to work on developing a resource guide for patients and for staff. And that's because our resources are always constantly changing. I feel like as soon as a resource guide comes out that shows where people can go to get additional support, then it's already become obsolete.
Right.
And so having somebody or a group of people in your clinical setting that are constantly working to keep that updated, to keep that...
Are there even phone apps that can
I think that technology is definitely moving us in the direction where we could keep track of these things.
Right.
I know of some really good resources that are being developed, and I know there's one for... housing in Atlanta in particular that has kind of a very comprehensive guide as to even it can tell you which shelters are open and available for that particular night. So there's a lot of technology that we can use. And then another important clinical intervention would be to refer patients to available supports. And so we talked about supported education and employment and housing and also poverty assistance programs. SNAP, which stands for the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, it's the thing we call food stamps, making sure people, that would be huge for food insecurity, making sure people have access to that, and any other number of supports that are in available. We have a lot of great supports in New York that we can refer people to.
And many of our clinical programs in OMH are involved with supported employment and education, and these are actually pretty well developed in New York. They're part of what any clinic, the OMH clinic or public clinic, can access, and makes a huge difference in terms of people's capacity to function in the community, to have a good life, and to have a life with dignity as well.
Yes. So in talking a little bit about policies that you might be able to do in your entire clinic or in the setting that you work in, a good example would be to really focus on providing culturally competent services. And that's something that you can always, I think any person practicing in any setting can always move towards becoming more culturally competent. And that could be any number of particular populations, but making sure the setting in which you work in is open and accepting to either refugees or LGBTQ populations or patients that come from low-income backgrounds or those folks with disabilities or developmental delays. Taking specific steps to make sure that the place in which you're providing services really addresses the needs of these particular vulnerable populations, I think is a really important way to help guide the setting that you're in to moving towards addressing some of these issues. And another way, just kind of on a very basic clinical intervention piece, would be if you work in a clinic, you could try to make the clinic more acceptable, more accessible for people so that they can access services. And so that includes things like having same-day appointments or allowing people to wait for an opening and still see those folks if rather than canceling appointments. And the reason for that is because we talked about how all of these determinants can contribute to so many factors, and having, you know, the built environment has a lot to do with transportation.
Yes.
If you're not able to effectively navigate transportation, you may not show up to your appointment on time. And, and many times we see that as somebody not necessarily being committed to their care when there could be other reasons for that. And so being accepting and open of that is one way that we can improve this.
Yes, and your use of acceptable around instead of access, I think is a perfectly good way to describe, because for many of our patients and families, access is going to be essential for their being able to accept care, like you were describing, that may be trouble with transportation, maybe a single mom with a sick kid, or even for some people who are so distressed to think about, well, I have an appointment next Tuesday at 4 o'clock, as opposed to, boy, it looks like, you know, I have some child care today, or I've got a day off from work. Now's when I'm going to go for care. This is about meeting people where they are.
Exactly.
And access is so essential to being able to enable people to get care.
I think I absolutely think
so. And many of our outpatient clinics now are focused on this open access. How can more people have care when they want it, when they're able to have it, rather than at the convenience of our scheduling, which, sometimes it's, bureaucracy has a life of its own.
And it's challenging.
You run an outpatient clinic.
I was going to say, it's not easy trying to balance kind of the day-to-day operations and making sure that you're operating as efficiently as possible, but yet still being open and accessible to the people that you serve.
Yes.
So this graph here kind of discusses each of the determinants that we've not really spent that much time on, and it kind of gives examples of things that you might be able to do to start to address these particular determinants.
So let's have our folks look at the left-hand side of this, because I'm concerned about all the small print on the right side.
Exactly.
So this is a resource slide, but let's have you concentrate on some of the bold type on the left.
And I think, you know, this is one of these slides that it's great for you to come back to, but you don't necessarily need to consider all of these options right at this moment, but to have a resource for the future. And we've already spent a little bit of time talking about discrimination and social exclusion. And so these are just examples, starting places for clinicians. So for instance, when we think about discrimination and social exclusion, it could just be a small step that you could take clinically could be to start thinking more about culture in your In your diagnostic evaluations. So the DSM-5 has a cultural formulation
right,
and a
right.
cultural formulation interview in the back of the DSM-5, and you could start to apply that to the individual interactions.
We had a grand rounds on that, I think it was last year.
Yeah, it's very key because it's an important way to help start to think about people's unique personal experiences because we get, once again, trapped in the day-to-day and we have lots of people to see and we're quite busy and overwhelmed, but we need to think about kind of what people are bringing to their understanding of what's going on with them, what their illness is, and that will help start to address some of these issues of discrimination and
social
exclusion. And
that's going to build an alliance, a stronger alliance with our patients if they know we understand what's going on in their world.
Exactly. Yeah. Or even, we don't even have to understand, we just have to express an interest
right.
in wanting to understand.
What a good point, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we've talked already, when we go back to that graph, we've talked about adverse early life experiences, and we talked about using the ACE score calculator. So that's an easy kind of quick clinical intervention that we could start to do. And then some of these other interventions are things that we're already doing and that clinicians could start to do on a limited basis in their own settings. So for poor education, you know, we know that supported education works, and so implementing that. For unemployment or underemployment, supported employment programs, we just implemented that in our own practice setting, and it's been very helpful to the patients that we see in terms of giving them hope for recovery. It's really quite key.
And those
key.
Are individual counselors, or this is a partnership you have with other programs?
This is a partnership. One of the benefits of our health system is that we have things that we can move to scale, and so we have psychiatric rehabilitation
right.
workers that were working at another site within our health system, and they basically kind of offered their services to us at our site, which has been wonderful because
right.
they've done some great work.
Right.
And then for poverty and income inequality, we've already talked about how a resource list might be really a good way to start, or just start screening for poverty, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. There's a screening tool for food insecurity. It's a one or two item
screening
test.
You had mentioned something called GINA before,
the Gini coefficient.
Yeah, what is that? Do you know what that acronym stands
it's
for?
It's not an acronym. No. It's actually named after the man,
oh, okay.
the economist
okay.
who created
okay.
the scale.
Okay, thank
so,
you.
So, yes, it seems like it would be an acronym
yeah, okay.
in this world of acronyms.
I was guessing something income.
Yes, right. he's an economist that focused on income inequality. So food insecurity has a one to two item screening test that you can just ask, and it's really, you know, was there any time at all where you felt unsure of where your next meal would come? It's that type of test.
There was a great film, I don't know if it was a documentary or not, called A Place at the Table.
That's a great
came out
documentary.
A year or two ago. Great film.
It's a wonderful film. And it's a great film for anybody to just better understand what's going on with food insecurity, particularly because they spend a lot of time with a young girl
who's
got behavioral problems and clearly would easily be diagnosed with ADHD.
Right.
And really the source of the problem is that she's hungry and food insecure.
Yes.
Yeah. So for poor housing quality and housing instability, there's a screening tool that's used by a group called Medical Legal Partnerships. The Medical Legal Partnerships, I actually think they're one of the success stories in groups that really effectively address the social determinants of mental health. They basically are, exactly as they describe, lawyers partnering with physicians and working in medical settings. And they don't have anything to do with criminal cases or issues, but they really work on making sure the legal system supports people in getting whatever services they need. For instance, if somebody's living in a poor housing quality situation, if there's a lot of mold and it's causing asthma or issues like that, their lawyers would get involved to sue or take legal action against the landlord in order to require them to make sure that they're in a reasonable living situation.
Right. Do they do also housing eviction cases as
well? They absolutely do. Mm-hmm. They absolutely do. And so they have a specific screening tool called iHelp, which really looks at several factors, any factors that would come up that they could address, including mm-hmm. things related to income, related to housing, related to education, immigration status. And mm-hmm. so that's a screening tool that's widely available online as well that you could use in your
mm-hmm.
practice.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we have the built environment, and we didn't spend... That's a whole nother topic in and of itself, because mm-hmm. like I said, the built environment is anything that's man-made in society, which is pretty much everything. and so how to fix the built environment becomes a huge, huge undertaking. And one of the clinical ways that you could start to think about it would be conducting a mental health impact assessment. That's a little bit too technical for what we're talking mm-hmm. about here today, but it just is a suggestion as to how one might proceed. And then in poor access...
When you say one, but not for an individual clinician, but for
no.
who?
It would probably be... it's really more... It's listed as a clinical measure, but it's really starting to think about things on the policy level.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so it would involve partnerships, which we're going to talk mm-hmm. about how important partnerships
yeah.
would be with outside non-health folks
right.
like city planners mm-hmm. and you know, policy of legal lawmakers
mm-hmm.
To look at any policy and what the mental health impacts of that policy
right,
might be,
right.
to look specifically at the mental health impacts of that policy.
Great.
And then the last suggestion I have on this list is related to poor access to care. And
mm-hmm.
we've already discussed how you could expand accessibility within your own clinic setting. So we've really, I think, come up with several options
mm-hmm.
for how somebody might take initial steps to address the social determinants of mental health.
Right, good. Let me use this moment to let our viewers know that we're going, in a few minutes, we're going to open the phone lines. And we hope you give us a call. Remember that to call, please call from another room to prevent you from going deaf and from us from going hearing all the screeching that happens when the speaker is on in the room or from where you're calling. So, but please give us a call. Our toll-free number is 1-877-280-7400. In previous broadcasts, we often invited emails, but we're having security wall problems and can't get those emails in this studio and print them out. So give us a call, 1-877-280-7400. Well, let's go on. A couple. Do you have other material as well? But call now. We'll stop to take your call.
So I would like to take a little bit of time because, remember, if we can think back to the health impact pyramid.
Yes.
Those things that we just talked about are acting really at the top and maybe starting to move a little bit down on the pyramid. But what we really want to do is get all the way down to the bottom of that pyramid,
mm-hmm.
the socioeconomic
mm-hmm.
factors. And when we think about that, we can kind of take a little bit of time to discuss some successes, some ways that people have developed innovative programs to work near the bottom of that pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And by talking about that, we're talking about policy programs and then policies that we might be able to think about as that are effective and work.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the things that have worked in addressing the social determinants of mental health include early childhood interventions,
right,
educational
right.
interventions.
These are really critical. Yes.
Very critical. So there's something called the High Scope Perry Preschool Program.
Mm-hmm.
And that program has really informed Head Start,
right.
which is an early educational intervention for children. And both of these programs, when implemented properly, have shown, when they follow out these kids up to age 40,
mm-hmm.
Really effective at decreasing poor
right.
mental health outcomes, and have also found less incarceration, higher rates of graduation from high school,
yes.
higher rates of...
which is associated with more jobs and income.
Exactly, yeah. higher income as right. a result. So yeah. so we know that early childhood interventions prevent kind of a whole host of negative factors. And so based on that information alone, we should be making it our business to...
Support Head Start.
Exactly, right? mm-hmm. and any other early childhood and mm-hmm. universal pre-K.
Like right,
these are,
yes.
These are interventions that really we know have a huge outcome. There's another intervention like this called the Good Behavior Game. I don't know if you're familiar with
it. No, I'm not.
It's a actual very basic intervention in which children are put into teams and taught behavioral, basically behavioral control. Mm-hmm. So they make it a game to kind of manage their behavior at a young age.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that the children that participate in the Good Behavior Game, they get rewards mm-hmm. and they get rewarded in teams. So if one of your teammates
right.
in your little group starts acting out, the peer pressure of that mm-hmm. group helps to
Great.
To mm-hmm. and that learning that behavioral regulation and that
right.
has led to incredibly positive outcomes with that just that intervention alone for those children in adulthood. So the same types of outcomes we see with Head Start.
Because it's a domino effect. Those are kids then that can be quieter in school, benefit from school, stay in school longer.
Exactly.
Not get yelled at and judged. And there's just one good thing happens.
It's true. Yes. And it seems like it's such a minor thing. You know, it's such a small intervention that mm-hmm. we can make that has a huge change in the course of somebody's life.
Yeah.
So these are things we need to think about figuring out how to implement.
Nurse-family partnership is yet another example.
Absolutely.
Do you want to describe that as
Nurse
well?
Nurse-family partnerships is a program that's set up so that when usually a teenage mother, but it could be just a younger mother, is pregnant,
mm-hmm.
During that period of time,
right.
nurses will do home visits with the mother, talk about healthy parenting, talk about helping.
Yeah, like coaches to the moms.
Exactly. And then they continue to visit for a short period of time after the baby is
this
born.
This is a very successful program. I'm going to interrupt us because we have one call and we have a few minutes left to take that
Great.
Call. Are you still with us?
Yes. Yes.
Yes, so welcome. Please tell us who you are and your thoughts.
Okay, I'm calling from Hillsboro Psychiatric Center. That's where I'm working the program. Oh, okay. I would like to ask a question.
We're having a hard time hearing you. There's a lot of static on the call.
Oh.
Go ahead, though.
Go ahead.
I'll try to make it out.
Okay.
All right. I'm calling from Kingsboro. I was trying to find out where domestic violence falls into this topic that you are sharing, which is the social determinants of mental health.
Okay.
By any chance, is the domestic violence part of it?
That's a great question. So the question is how does domestic violence fall into this whole topic? And I think both domestic violence and violence are probably two kind of major. So both domestic violence and violence are two highly overarching principles. When we think about these determinants, I consider them to be like risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
I consider the social determinants to lead to these actual negative outcomes. So those underlying determinants then lead to domestic violence, then lead to more other types of violence in society. So I see them as kind of the negative outcomes
mm-hmm.
that come out of these particular determinants.
Right. So this is the product of the causes of causes,
exactly.
Domestic violence and other forms of violence, and ones, though, that are very much part of our patients' experience as well, And we've got to be mindful of that, because if somebody is afraid of their life at home, we've got to be helping them get the right kind of protection and support.
Yes.
To prevent catastrophic.
Yeah. And it, of course, it leads to trauma.
Yes.
You know, and
yes.
And so we know that trauma is very bad and very bad for one's mental health. And we can think about, when we talk about adverse early life experiences, mm-hmm. we talk about how even a child witnessing domestic
yes.
violence, that's an adverse early childhood experience. That's considered an ACE. So the witnessing of it has a huge impact on the child.
Yes.
But then also the experience of it for the person then, of course, leads to further health
right.
problems.
Yeah, all the consequences of trauma, not only for the person directly impacted, but particularly for children or other members of the family.
Exactly.
Okay. We still have a few more minutes. Are there a couple other key points you wanted to make before we need to close?
Yeah, I just wanted to spend a little bit of time thinking about how we might make policy changes.
Mm. Yes.
And so, you know, I don't think that psychiatrists and social workers and psychologists, I don't think that we ourselves can just go out there and say, hey, everybody, let's give everyone a living wage.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things we can do is that we're actually experts. We're experts in the field of mental health and wellness.
Mm-hmm.
And so when these decisions are being made, when people are making policy decisions, I think we actually owe it to ourselves to be at the table.
Yes.
And so we should be providing this expertise that we have to our local lawmakers, our city councils, any type of political venues that we have, but also to our schools,
mm-hmm.
to our neighborhoods, and to our communities. And we should be partnering with other groups of people. So they could be teachers, they could be law enforcement, they could be urban planners, any number of groups that have these same goals and interests in mind.
Mm-hmm.
We should be thinking about ways that we can interact with them more,
right.
and bring our knowledge of mental health to the table when they're making decisions about policies.
Some of our colleagues may not know how to go about that. Sometimes it's done through their professional associations.
Yes.
So they're getting involved with their professional associations and ensuring that their professional associations are making themselves available through these individuals to be part of some effort to improve this particular problem or that particular problem. That's where we bring a lot of credibility to the table when it comes time to influencing social policy.
Yeah, I think that's key because we organize in these groups, and getting together in our professional organizations, we have more power to be able to speak on these issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's very important.
Yeah. But it may well be that it's through a group at parents at school. It may be through a church-based group or religious-based activities that people are involved in that are very prominent in their own respective communities. There are different ways that we can bring our expertise and our voice. It's more a matter of our saying, how can I help?
Exactly.
You know, hey, I'm a doctor. I see what happens in my office with my patients. How can I help? I know I'm not going to be the one that's going to change this, but maybe together we all can change this.
Exactly. I think that's a great way to put it. And I think we don't spend enough time thinking about that, the impact that we have and
mm-hmm.
the impact that we can make. And I rarely do I think people, when you offer your help and assistance,
yeah.
will turn you down or
yeah.
say they're not interested. So it's just a matter of us taking the time to be more
Yeah, active. The likelihood is that people will say yes.
Exactly.
And so, you know, but so you better be prepared, because, in fact, you may be a real benefit to some person or persons, groups, community organizations.
Yes.
And that's the kind of natural partnerships that can make a difference. So it's not about any of our clinicians becoming either politicians or becoming poverty lawyers. Mm-hmm. It's about our finding those others who are encountering the same problems and figuring out how to work together.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's strength in numbers here, and given the prevalence of these problems and the profound impact, this is what you were starting at the very beginning to say, which is we owe this.
We do.
To our patients. And you've seen examples where it works, not only in this city, but other cities.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. There's countless examples. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation does in fact have a report that's success stories. Mm-hmm. And that's for the social determinants of health in general, but I think a lot of this applies to mental health as well.
Yeah, and that's what your book with Michael Compton has compiled. You've talked about each in turn of these 9 or 10 key areas, mm-hmm. And brought in experts to talk about what these problems are, how they impact mental health specifically, and how clinicians can make a difference?
Exactly. We actually give case examples, mm-hmm. for each of these determinants,
yeah.
and then talk about ways that you can make clinical and policy interventions on each of these determinants.
Right.
In greater
detail. So you've written a type of handbook, a practical handbook around what some people may think, oh, that's somebody else's business.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you bring that up because, you know, that becomes the issue. A lot of people think this isn't our responsibility, but it is our responsibility,
yeah.
because it affects our patients, and we got into the business to help our patients, and this may be one of the greatest ways that we can achieve that.
Right, and I think it's also an example of how many other really smart people are working in this area, because you've brought together a real powerhouse of people to write and to illustrate the kind of ways these problems occur and what we can all do about them.
Yeah.
So thanks for your contributions in that regard as well. I'm going to finish up now. We're just about out of time, and we want to have some closing statements. So we want to offer the following take-home messages for clinicians. First, the social determinants of mental health are the circumstances, as we've said, into which we are born, grow up, live, work, and age that impact upon mental health and well-being. Second, that risk factors are what drive disease, but they themselves are driven by our environment and how we live our lives. That's what determines our health and mental health, and that's what Dr. Shim has so beautifully illustrated. These are the causes of the causes. And third, social determinants are the circumstances and opportunities, or lack of opportunities, that affect our mental health. They're deeply influenced by public policies and social norms. And we can affect the social determinants of mental health in our clinical practice and by working with others in the community who serve our patients. So, Ruth, thank you so much for coming and being such a terrific educator.
It's great to be here.
We value your opinion, so please take a moment to complete a brief evaluation for this Grand Rounds. The evaluation contains 5 multiple choice questions and 1 write-in question that will tell us how you will be able to use this information from this program in your daily clinical practice, and we use that to inform our future programming as well. And speaking about future programming, we hope you'll join us again on November 18th for our next statewide Grand Rounds. Our guest is going to be one of our great clinical directors at South Beach, Dr. Paige Burkholder. And the focus for the Grand Rounds will be CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, for psychosis. Until then, thank you for watching and be well.